to the FTN Show.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined tonight by Adam Camilleri.
Hey everybody, hello.
Yo man, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me again, and again, and again, and again. It's like you can't get nothing. There's some kind of relationship building here. I don't quite know what it is, but I like it.
I kind of like that we get to have these conversations, even though you're on the actual other side of the world.
Legitimate other side of the world. Like, we are almost a day's travel from each other, like a full day.
Yep. I may have another couple of segments insert in this show. One may be a vendor spotlight where we talk about another miniature game, and then one from another content producer. I'm always hesitant to say like who's going to be in the show because, you know, if something happens where we don't record, then I've got this weird editing situation I have to do. But I've got some cool stuff lined up, and I hope you guys enjoy it.
Fantastic, man. Well, I can't wait to hear. I enjoyed the last one. I listened through, not for myself, but it was a spot with Josh Diffie I wanted to listen to, who's like my other half in Down Under Pairings. Man. And yeah, a bunch of other, all the other segments you put in were fantastic as well. Who was the gentleman from Brohammer who won the Armageddon series?
That's Daniel Smith. Yeah, great player, nice guy. Yeah.
Yeah, seems like a lovely dude.
Yeah, really enjoyed talking to him and meeting him over the course of the series. Then, I mean, Diffie, what a prince.
He's a legend, absolute legend.
So if you happen to miss that last show because it was, 3 hours long, go back and take it in bite-sized chunks. Diffie's in the front. People complain also I don't put timestamps in this stuff.
We're talking about Tau today, yeah?
Tau, and we might be able to work in a little Gene Stealer cult stuff. I've been trying new hobby things I want to talk about. I came up with a neat thing. Whatever, I think it's neat.
I just want to clear one thing up. I don't call them Tau anymore. I call them tuna beef, or I call them the fish cows, because they've got gills and they've got hooves. So I think this Tau Empire stuff, they're only called that because their homeworld was called Tau, yeah? So they don't actually have a species name. Tyranids don't have a species name. They're named after the word tyrant. So we need to, or what is it, whatever it's called, Thai or some crap. But we need to give Tau an actual species name, and it is, bam, tuna beef.
And there's got to be a Latin, what's the angelicized tuna beef?
Yeah, somebody do that. Somebody do that in the comments. Look up the Latin for tuna beef. Put those two words together. We're going to start a movement, a revolution. We're going to force G-Dub's hand. The next Tau Codex will have to be Latin tuna beef.
There you go. Yeah. So with with the Tau in this book, I mean, we got a new Shadow Sun.
Yeah, that model is phenomenal. And in like G-Dub's, I think, ritual now, if anyone that can have the fly keyword, any infantry model that can have the fly keyword must be perched on something with one foot. Like, it's just a requirement. You look at Shrike, you look at all the fly characters they've brought out for the last, like, probably year and a half. They're all perched on one foot off like some kind of ruin.
It helps them seem epic, though. I don't mind.
It absolutely does. I don't mind either. It's just a funny trend. And that model, wow. I know it's all armor. She's just, but man, she's like twice as big as she was before.
I like it.
I really like it as well. She looks a lot more intimidating, a lot more brutal, a lot more, she's going to mess you up.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's got, of course, this, persona of the character that people appreciate. And then, I don't know, for me, you know, not being like a Super Tau follower or fan, it's, you ever played Metroid?
Yes, absolutely.
I played the entire first level of Metroid thinking Samus was a dude.
Yep.
And I mean, this is, I'm like 9 or something or whatever. And then after you beat it, and then she removes her helmet, I'm like, what is happening?
You're like, huh?
Yeah. Then I played it. I love Metroid 1, by the way. It was an amazing game. You could play it continuously. I think I beat it 16 times in a row one time without dying.
Jeez. Yeah, dude, back in the day. Remember how brutal games used to be? Like, you died once, start over, like no save points, no nothing. You just, did you have the cheat codes? Back to the start, baby.
I'm really showing my age. There's another game called Rygar, where there was no way to save it at all. You had to play it until, I guess, you gave up. That was basically it.
My one was Altered Beast. It was a Sega game, but it was also an arcade game. Altered Beast was my, like,
those tiny heads.
Yeah, just jumping out at you. And at the start, he's like, rise from your grave. And then you just jump straight into the game. It was so sick.
Yep. That was good. Sorry, I know we're getting a little off topic. Anyway, I had previously, you know, until it became very well known, I had no idea that Shadow Sun was female. But I think it's this model definitely does her some justice. And, you know, when you mentioned being perched up on the things, that's one. I think it's one of the is one of like the single greatest things about the character keyword, is that you can have these things look as cool as they do and not be necessarily subject to the true line of sight. drawback?
I've got a 30K model, Tech Marine model that I use for one of my Thunderfire gunners or as a Tech Marine. And he's got an antenna. And my God, the amount of times I wanted to cut that antenna off because a Vindicare assassin was just like, oh, that's a nice antenna you got. It'd be a shame if I shot you in the head because of your antenna.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Like scenic bases and stuff. Like there was using, you know, Marines with scenic bases that would put them a little bit too tall to not be able to hide behind a rhino.
Yeah, that's very true.
So brutally frustrating when people would be like, no, I'm shooting you, man. I'm shooting you. Like, come on. You know that I'm hiding behind the rhino. Oh, sorry. I see the very top of your head.
Yeah, exactly right. That's always a rough conversation to have here in a game as well, because you both have different expectations about what's going to happen there.
The character model, the character keyword in this game lets you have these really epic looking figures and you don't have to worry about that.
She got a new data slate as well. She got new guns, didn't she?
New everything.
Yeah.
Well, at least from the point of, I think you have options where you didn't necessarily have them before.
Yeah, well, I know she's got two different guns. She got like the dispersed fusion blaster, which is assault 2, 18-inch, strength 7, minus 4, D3. And when it's in half range, you roll 2d3 and discard 1.
Yes, so it's like a baby. Two.
It's like a baby melter though. So it's d3 damage, not d6. And you take 2d3, take the highest. So you capped at 3 damage. But yeah, two shots. And if in your meta you've got more Primaris Marines than say vehicles and mechanized or knights and stuff, this is just a good choice.
Yeah. Hang on a second. Yeah, for each high energy fusion blaster this model is equipped with, it can instead be equipped with one dispersed fusion blaster. So you can get two. Yeah. So you shoot 4 shots.
Nice. Yeah. I like that. I like that in the Marine matter. I think that's pretty good.
Yeah.
And the other one's just a regular fusion gun, isn't it? Or has it got better range?
It's called the high energy fusion blaster, which is 24-inch range.
Yeah. That's pretty good. I don't mind either of those choices. But she can be taken. What's the other rule? She can be taken in any sept detachment now, but she only gets the double Kalyon if she's in a Tau detachment.
A Tau Empire detachment, yeah. Yeah, model can be included in a Tau Empire detachment without preventing other units in the detachment from gaining a Sept Tenant. Note, however, that this model does not benefit from any Sept Tenant unless the Sept Tenant selected for that detachment is Coordinated Fire Arcs.
Yeah. So she can't double Monkar, she can't double Kalyon, or even single Monkar or Kalyon, because those stay models of the same Sept, and she'd stay Tau Sept, and she'd join like a Violar or...
Has more special rules though. The Genius of Kalyon. Once per battle, this model can declare Kalyon, even if Kalyon or Monkar has already been declared. Monkar and Kalyon cannot be both declared in the same turn. So yeah, she would not get. Yeah, you're right. She would not get it.
Yeah, she wouldn't give it to the ones around her if they're not Tau Sept. Which is fair. I think that's fair. You can't just slot her in and double tap into whichever one you want. And then there would be like, you could just, the world would go crazy. The skies would fall.
I've already mentioned that I am not a Tau player, so Adam is walking me through some of this. It's baby steps. Hold my hand.
Yeah, I played Tau for the Australian ETC team in 2019. So that was my first foray into Tau in 8th edition. I didn't learn a lot about them. Naturally, I tried to do my best to get as good as I could with them. But yeah, it sounds like they've gone to a whole new level. The things I would like to see from this book, and I'm not sure whether this has done it or not. What I struggled with was the inflexibility of Tau. It's like you built your army around a certain play style, and then it either played that way and won, or it played that way and lost. I didn't feel like they were dynamic enough. I couldn't change on the fly and make them do things. There was a lot of things they weren't equipped to. Like in the bottom of the ninth, I needed to be on the other side of the board. I'm like, my army's not equipped to get to the other side of the board. I didn't bring cold stars. I didn't bring deep strike units. I didn't. Yep, looks like I'm not getting line breaker. Stuff like that. I'd be really happy if this gave some more flexibility. Like some of those units, you really like. I freaking love stealth suits. I love crisis suits. They're like to me, them and commanders are the things that I think about when I think of Tau. I think suits. But I don't think Riptides or Broadsides. I think Crisis Suits and Stealth Suits and Commanders and things like that.
Oh, see, I love that. That's what really got me. Like, I wasn't a huge fan of the... Like, I love the anime aesthetic. Like, I do... Like, big robots. Robotech is my jam. Like, if you're a big robot, stompy robot, I'm cool. Transform Z, you know, all that kind of stuff. I'm with you, right? But there was always something kind of missing, in my opinion, from the original, like, when they first debuted type Tau, but they really nailed it with the Ghost Keels and the Riptides and the new broadsides. That's like, I love those guys.
Oh, I can't say anything bad about any of their models. I don't think they have a bad looking model. Maybe Vespid.
They don't count.
But apart, No, they don't count. But yeah, they don't have a, there's not a bad model in the range. I mean, for my aesthetic and what I like about the game, there's nothing I look at and go, wow, that's mind-blowingly good. But at the same time, I can't poke and say anything's bad. Like, it's all pretty adequate.
I think they got where they wanted to go with the Storm Surge and the Super Tuna and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So structured wise, this isn't structured like a marine release. It's not structured around like a Doctrine or a Mono Bonus. They're structured more like Eldar, where they get like a make your own sept. Yeah.
Yeah, they do. They got there's some sept tenets, where the same thing, you can make your own craft world essentially with picking two of the sept tenets.
Matt, read me some. Let's dive into this.
I'll jump right to the one that I think is the best or my favorite so far is the Upgunned. Burst cannons models with this tenet are equipped with have an armor penetration characteristic of neg one.
Awesome. Amazing. So it's free ATS. So either you can not take ATS and take more guns, or you can take ATS on top and go to neg two. That's really good. That's legitimately very, very good. Yeah. And so like other ones, you get to pick two of these.
You do. Yeah. Yeah. So if I, you know, the burst cannons and stuff, I think it's got high rates of fire and
yeah, it's
you
four
know,
shots, it's, four it's shots, kind of, five. Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of intimidating when, you know, like, oh, I've got all these burst cannons and all these smart missiles and stuff. I'm just pick up all these dice and roll them, you know, but then when you make your saves, you know, you realize that they're, you know, they had to kind of get lucky to do something. This extra neg one AP, I think, is a huge boom to them.
So that means on a crisis suit, you can take three burst cannons and have this and still have negative one. So is that's 12 shots from one crisis suit. That's 12 bolter shots. Sorry, heavy bolter shots, strength five minus one. Or you take two burst cannons and you take ATS as well, and you've got eight shots at strength five minus two. That's not bad, because I can tell you from what I know of the game, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but for as far as I've been playing eighth, I think that strength five weapons strength is the best one you can spam. If you can spam strength five, you're in a good place, because strength five can handle anything.
Agreed.
It's good at it's yeah. On mass, strength five takes care of everything. Yeah.
I got this theory for a long time that if you don't have to really invest a lot of points, like if you essentially get strength six for free, that's probably the best gun in the game.
And yeah, but it's I think apart from Eldar, no other real army can spam strength six. But a lot of others can spam strength five. And now, because of doctrines and things, Marines have been able to spam strength five minus one, strength five minus two. And now Tau can as well. Tau had more strength five guns than anybody else, really, because like a fire warrior has strength five, burst cannons are strength five. And you're telling me now that like burst cannons, which was like the base weapon on stealth teams, one of the better spammable weapons on crisis teams, on ghost kills, having a, you know, two of them.
You get them on the transports too, right? Like you could have.
Yeah. Yeah. And on, yeah, you can, they're on most things. And so now, yeah, they're just making all your best spammable gun, like, better. Awesome. Good deal.
Yeah. There's a one called Maneuvering Thrusters. This is the one, it's battle suit specific. A battle suit unit with this tenet can advance when it falls back.
Oh, okay.
I think that's the only thing that we've seen that can advance when it falls back.
Yeah. I've never heard of anybody else being able to. But that's an interesting, I'm trying to think of what applications you have that for. Like, I mean, I guess if you, I mean, a lot of units can't kill, stealth teams, sorry, not stealth teams, crisis suits in combat or ghost kills or riptides in combat. And then when like, let's say you're like Harlequins then at that point. So when you fall back, you can just flip over people and go deeper into their army and trying to get to characters or onto objectives. I mean, I don't think that's something you build your army around, but it's a nice little bit of tech to have in your back pocket.
Do they have assault weapons? Like, do they have fly and then be assault weapons to be able to?
Did you say what was it locked to? Was it locked to battlesuit units?
Battlesuit units, yeah.
Every battlesuit unit except for broadsides has fly.
But do they have assault weapons also? Could they even benefit from? What you're trying to do is like get out of range. Or, you know, maybe you're surrounded, you can then hop far enough away if, you know, for some reason, if you could not.
I think apart from the high yield missile pods and I think apart from SMS and high yield missile pods and then the riptide weapons, I think everything else, literally everything else is assault. Maybe not the plasma rifles. But I know burst cannons are, missile pods are, the fusions are. Is cyclic ions? I'm not sure cyclic ions are. They might be heavy as well. But yeah, I definitely know SMS, the heavy burst, well, all the riptide guns and all the broadside guns. But I was quite sure, apart from the rail rifles, the crisis suit guns are all pretty much assault.
There's another trait called hybridized weaponry. Sorry, did you have another point on the...
No.
Add 4 to the range characteristic of assault and grenade weapons models with this tenet are equipped with. And this doesn't apply to prototype weapon systems, which we're going to talk about in a minute. But
so on fusion, that becomes quite relevant. I think their fusion guns are 18 inches for just a regular fusion, not for the ones Shadow Sun has. But I think they're 18 inches, so them going to 22 inches and then being 11 inches for two dice take the highest, meaning you can get that from the deep strike. So you can deep strike an enforcer commander and then have him with fusions getting 2d6 to take the highest off the deep strike. That's not a terrible idea, even though fusions are still quite expensive. I hear there's one I want to talk about, and I think you upgunned, and this one are the best combo that I can think of right now. Stabilizing systems.
All right. I was going for hardened warheads, but let's see what you got.
Yep. Hit me. I think it's ignoring the penalty for moving and shooting.
Yeah, when resolving an attack made with a ranged weapon by a battle suit model with this tenet, the model does not suffer the penalty for moving and firing heavy weapons.
Yeah. So between that, that's a target lock. So on a Riptide, you buy a target lock support system and you can ignore the penalty for moving and shooting. And then upgunned is ATS. So, I think the one you were about to talk about is the boost AP on missile pods and SMS, yeah?
Yep.
So you pick the one, you pick the either upgunned or hardened warheads, depending on what you're building your list around. I suppose if it's more, Riptide broadside heavy, you probably want to go a hardened warhead. If it's more stealth suits, crisis suits, things like that, maybe mechanized, with the burst cannons on your devilfish or hammerheads, you'd go upgunned. And then you take that, the stabilization systems. If you're playing like Riptides, broadsides, or even things like, I just need you to double check something. I can't remember if hammerheads and skyrays ignore the penalty for moving and shooting. I believe they don't. And they, like, I mean, when I used to play them, I think I was relying on Markalites to make sure that they, got off their full complement at max ballistic skill. But, you can double, or it was because I was bunkering up around, long strike. But let me just double check. I can pick it up really quick. Yeah. Here's another unit. I hope this book does something for their flyers, for tower flyers, guys.
There are some benefits, the things that do help the flyers. I don't think it helps them enough, but yes.
Mm. Yeah, so there's nothing that makes a skyray ignore the penalty for moving and shooting, and there is nothing that makes a hammerhead ignore the penalty for moving and shooting. So even on hammerheads and mechanized armies, that actually gets quite a bit of value. So because, like I said at the start, one of the things that kind of bothered me about tau was that the best tau list that me and my team came up with at the time was it was exceptionally static. And we know that a lot of the mission structures we play these days, if you're not absolutely clubbing your opponent off the board and wiping them off, they can run away with hold-to-hold maws, recons, bonus points, engineers, things like that. They can just outscore you, even if you're killing them like by the drove. Making tau being already super, super effective in shooting, and now I'm getting a lot of what sounds like quite a bit of dynamic movement added, like, you know, falling back and advancing, being able to deep strike and then effectively shoot fusion guns and all these other things, making crisis teams and things held in reserve more effective.
There's a turbo jets one too, which gives +2 inches to like jetpack stuff.
A jetpack, so that would be pretty much crisis suits. Is there anything else that has jetpack? Maybe the commanders and stuff have jetpack too.
Well, I mean, these are things that are durable and things that have typically hit a little bit better or whatever. I mean,
yeah, it's true.
Talking about being places and being able to deliver some good weaponry sometimes.
So when you think about advantage, you think about Riptides. Yeah, so Riptides, you can get two support systems, and usually it's either a target lock or velocity tracker and ATS. You're pretty much always going to take ATS because SMS with -1 and burst cannons going from -1 to minus, so heavy bursts going from -1 to -2 is a very big deal. So you're always going to take ATS. Not having to take target lock and being able to have all the benefits of target lock and take velocity tracker, all of a sudden you've actually just opened up that model to being good in every matchup.
Talking about the advanced targeting system, a model equipped with an advanced targeting system increases the AP characteristic of all its weapons by 1.
It's very strong. Very, very strong.
Yeah. Like, so that's why you take it. And then these other things would give it even another +1.
Yeah, exactly right. So just checking on plasma rifles. Yeah, I thought plasma rifles were they're rapid fire 1. And then I just need to find out if the cyclic ions, going back to our last point about the which weapons.
The cyclic ion is assault 3. Yeah, it's assault weapon.
Oh, geez, nice. Yeah. All right, that's awesome. So the biggest beneficiaries I see for the
Raker, sorry to jump in, is heavy. That may be what you were thinking about.
That's the Ghost Kill one, I believe. Yeah. Pretty sure it's the Ghost Kill weapon. The cyclic ion.
The blaster is assault.
Yeah. I think that's the that's what you get on your commanders, the Big Iron Blaster, and the Iron Raker. Yeah, that's the essentially it's a battle cannon for a Leman Russ. You know, a heavy six, strength eight, minus one, usually minus two with ATS, D3 damage, and that's what you take on your Ghost Keels. Now, see, Ghost Keels, I think, are awesome. I think they are very, very cool. They play in a very unique way. They play the game in a very unique way, being a monster that infiltrates this. I suppose the best comparison for them now would be like Invicta Warsuits operate pretty similar to what a Ghost Keel does. Yeah, I just thought of that then, but no, that makes sense because they're a mechanized or a monster unit that infiltrates. It's got quite good shooting. It's toughness 6, I think Ghost Keel toughness 6. There might be toughness 5 though. And yeah, they rely on quite a bit of a decent amount of resilience for the points, but they're quick. They're both quick units. They're dynamic. They do a lot of things and they have a fairly decent amount of shooting. Now, I do think because of all the marine buffs, the Invicta is a bit more killy than the Ghost Keel, but hey, with these buffs, man, I'd love to see Ghost Keels become a factor again.
Yeah, there's another cool thing, Gifted Pilots. This is limited, I think more limited use, but see what you think. If in your movement phase, a vehicle or monster model with this tenet does not move or moves a distance less than half its move characteristic until the end of the turn when resolving an attack made with a ranged weapon by that model, reroll a wound roll of 1.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's nice. Can't complain about that.
You know, I mean, I know what you can use it with is a bit, I guess, short list.
Restricted.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ghost Keels are toughness 6, by the way. So that is the same as the Invicta. The Invicta has 13 of wounds or something crazy. The Ghost Keel only has 10.
Yep.
But mind you, when you add in the 2 wounds that Stealth Drones has, which is actually a separate unit, so never mind. But there is 2 more wounds there.
Well, I brought it up because they have the monster keyword.
Yeah, it's true.
So like Riptides and Ghost Keels, they have the monster keyword.
Do Storm Surges have the monster keyword as well? I got a funny feeling they do.
Storm Surge? I can tell you in a second. I thought they were the only vehicle.
They're vehicle and Titanic. That's right, because they're not a monster. And they didn't get all the benefits of being... Never mind. That's another rabbit hole.
There's very, very careful with how they've distributed some of the keywords around the Tau book. But they are a vehicle, right? So they would get the benefit of these Gifted Pilots.
Yes, that's true, actually. Yeah, so, and notoriously, there's only one real, there's 2 ways that Tau have to interact with the wound dice that I know of off the top of my head. That is the stratagem where a commander can choose to not shoot and then give a battlesuit unit rerolls to wound. And then there's the Tau sept strat. Having another way to interact with it, because they don't have like a lieutenant equivalent. They don't have anything that just sits there with an aura of reroll ones to wound.
And these aren't sept tenets. These aren't things that you can just layer on without sacrificing the septs, you know, in the book. So
yes.
I'm not necessarily advocating these, but I do think that something like this gives a little bit of beef to the Ghost Keels and the Storm Surge, which are unrepresented units on the battlefield today.
Absolutely agreed, 100%. Moving on, there's prototype weapon system. What can you tell me about that?
Oh, well, these are neat. All right. So these are, they're relics, essentially, but you can give them to other units. So, for instance, there is a Magna Rail Rifle, which it's just for a broadside unit only. This weapon system replaces each heavy rail rifle model in this unit are equipped with and has the following profile. Magna Rail Rifle, 60-inch range, heavy 2, which I think is the normal rail rifle profile, -4 AP, D6 damage. When resolving an attack made with this weapon, a wound roll of a 6+ inflicts 1 mortal wound on the target in addition to any other damage. From resolving an attack made by this weapon, a damage roll of 1 or 2 counts as 3 instead.
Yeah, that's sick. I love that. Because like D6 damage, like you would rather flat 3, yeah? I would rather have a flat 3 damage weapon than a D6 damage weapon. I don't know if I'm unique or weird in that way, but 100%, that's my preference.
So you get these, just so I can tell you get these, instead of selecting a signature system for your warlord, you can instead upgrade a unit with one of these prototype weapon systems.
Oh, so it's similar to Tank Ace.
Yeah, it's for the whole unit, so that would apply, like, the Magna Rifle is for the whole broadside unit.
Yeah, so you can take 3 in a unit, so it would be, all 3. I like that. It's quite a good thing. And then on top of that, that unit can now move and shoot without penalty and can still take ATS velocity trackers. And, that becomes very threatening against flyers, strength 9, minimum 3 damage, And they're neg three on those heavy rail rifles, I believe.
Neg four on this magnum rail rifle.
So all those little storm surges and stuff going about, you can just one shot kill them. And minimum, like those two, you get two hits, two wounds. They won't get a save unless they're in cover. And then you do minimum six damage. That's really nice. That's quite good. I like that.
I think that's, for free?
Yeah. For literally, did you say you have to give up a warlord trade for it?
You do. You have to give up the relic. So rather than giving your Tau Empire character model a signature system from the Tau Empire Codex, you can select a prototype weapon system for one Tau Empire unit from your army.
So this is the same as Tank Aces, except for Guard, Tank Aces have to give up your Warlord trait. For this one, you have to give up your Relic.
Yep.
Now, see, here's the difference, yeah? Guard Warlord traits are really, really, really good. Tau Relics are not that good. they're actually not that good. Like, there's nothing hard. I don't think there's anything heartbreaking there. People are going to miss that much. I mean, there was the Neurochip. Where you literally get you one, it was the standard, like one reroll to hit to wound throughout the game. And also you, on a six, you got command points back, either yours or your opponent's. Like that compared to giving up Grand Strategist or giving up what I say are old grudges.
Yep.
You would, to make a unit of three broadsides that you were planning to take like infinitely better, you would, wouldn't you? You'd give up that relic. Well, for my mind, you would. Is there a strategy that lets you do it anyway? Like there is for Tank Aces, like you can take your wallet and get a Tank Ace?
There is not, no. There isn't here on this page. There may be something in the actual strategies themselves, which we're not there yet, but not here. I don't think so. Okay. As soon as I say that, I'm gonna flip the page and be wrong. But you know, we'll see. I think the fact that you can give up something on one thing and get it on three things,
yeah,
is really not bad.
Yeah. I agree entirely. I think it's a no-brainer.
There's another prototype web system called the Annihilation Warheads. This is for storm surges. When resolving an attack made with a destroyer missile by this model, if it scores a hit, do not roll to determine the number of mortal wounds suffered by the target unit. That unit suffers three mortal wounds.
That's actually pretty good. So how many warheads does a storm surge? I think that four. Means they shoot 12 four. Mortals.
Yeah, I think if you get four missiles, so it would be 12 mortals.
Yeah, 12 mortals. So you just you give up your relic, and is that something you like Tank Aces? You can do at the start of the game, or do you have to write in your list?
It's the start of the game. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, whenever you pick your relic, right? So
yeah, well, I guess you in some format you do have to select your relic before the tournament and stuff. So maybe you are locked in that way. But you rock out, you're playing nice. I guess I'm doing the warheads. Because I guess I'm gonna half kill this knight for literally free.
Yeah, four destroyer missiles.
I'm gonna half kill it before I shoot any guns. That feels good. Through your 4+ invuln. And that's the big deal as well. You're like, okay, well I'm gonna shoot every warhead at this knight, and then I'm gonna shoot one gun at it. And then like they're gonna go, okay, well, I have to rotate, and then you're like, every other gun's here.
Yeah. Although the destroyer missiles don't hit very often.
Yeah, you have to put marker lights. So they hit on ballista skill if you have, I think it's two or three. Is it three marker lights? Because they hit on sixes. Otherwise, if you try to shoot a destroyer missile without any marker light support, it hits on sixes, which is pretty ordinary. It's only two marker lights. So two marker lights and they hit on ballista skill. And a storm surge hits on fours, but you can drop your anchors to hit on threes. So yeah, with two marker lights, you'd be hitting on threes. You're rolling ones because you already got one marker light there. So it's actually very reliable.
Well, with a little help.
With a little help. And of course, if you went to five marker lights and you dropped your anchors, you'd be hitting on twos rerolling. So you got four shots hitting on twos rerolling to do flat three mortal wounds. That's possibly one of the best returns in the game.
Especially on a real stout unit. I mean, there's...
Yeah, and from 60 inches away. You've got 60-inch range on those missiles.
Yeah, I mean, that's killing... You're killing Mortarion and Magnus.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, well, you're taking them down to a couple of wounds left. They're taking them down to four wounds left. Well,
I mean, but you just... your one model is killing them, and the rest of your army is there.
Oh, yeah. If you shot every just, like, four destroyers and the rest of his guns, surely the rest of his guns together would do four wounds to, like... Yeah, to one of those models.
Sometimes the dice doesn't work out.
For my mind, when I think of this, I think of a Leviathan Dreadnought, which has 14 wounds, and it's exceptionally hard to get any damage through. Now, if you shoot four destroyer missiles that do flat three mortal wounds that all get allocated one at a time, they bypass all the Ironstone, all the damage reduction, and I believe I'm not 100% how they interact with the Martyrdom stratagem, but with you remove the Martyrdom stratagem, you've just taken it down to two wounds left. Couple of burst cannons go in and finish that guy off now. Like, so that unkillable could not be killed before Leviathan Dreadnought just got killed by like three burst cannons and one storm surge.
one phantom storm surge that you have never seen in a game before.
That you've never seen before. You're still not going to see. Well, probably still not going
to
see.
You might. I like the way that model looks. I'd love an excuse to put one on the table. Like, if I could just make an army of, like, one Super Tuna and three Storm Surges, I probably would play that.
As in the Super Tuna being a town, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I love it.
I don't think that's possible.
What else we got?
Those are my two favorites of the stuff. Yeah, but there's something here for everybody. So here's high-powered incinerators, battlesuit unit only. The weapon system replaces each flamer. The models in the units are equipped with and has the following profile. 8-inch range, so nothing changed there. Assault D6, nothing changed there. When resolving an attack made with this weapon, do not make a hit roll. It automatically scores a hit. I think we knew that already. When resolving an attack made by the weapon against a unit, this one half range, add one to the strength characteristic. So if you're up close and personal, strength 5.
Yep, that's not terrible.
No, I'd still rather be doing all those mortal wounds or blowing you off the table with the railroad.
Yeah, well, I guess if I was going to take, yeah, for sure. The mortal wounds is just sexy. If you're going to take a storm surge, 100% you'd probably do that. jumping over to stratagems. There's the one that jumped out to me. I think Warhammer community told us about this one. This is the one for crisis battle suit. So a 2 CP. They pick a unit and shoot at it as though they had 5 Markalites. Like, yeah, all right.
Well, that's what we just talked about, right? You don't even make... Because Markalites, right, what are their normal range? 24?
Yeah, no, 36. 36, I believe.
They are normally 36-inch range?
I believe they are. Let me double check on that, because that's something I don't want to get wrong. Yep, 36. Heavy one, 36.
Oh, okay, maybe that's what it... Heavy one, right? So if they have to move to get in range, they're -1. There's actually a network Markalites experimental weapon that makes them assault one.
Oh, so you put on a unit of Pathfinders.
Yeah, it is for a Pathfinder team, yep.
Nice. Yeah, that's not too bad.
All right, so anyway, going back, I know that it's not always hard to get as many Markalites as you want on something, especially when you're firing into things that have negs to hit or originally. So just being able to burn some CP.
Well, so when I played Tau, I was playing, I've got a meta that was very heavy on -1s to hit, either that being Chaos, Tau, or Tyranids, Genes of the Cult. And so I dropped all my Markalites. I dropped all of them. I didn't take any Markalites because there was no point. I was better off just taking more drones and just wearing people down, just being like, hey, I'm not going to blow you off the board, and I'm going to do less damage than I want, but because I've got more guns and more drones, I'm going to last longer and I'm going to be there to shoot longer at better strength, more reliable, things like that. Sorry, less reliable, but more density. You know what I mean?
Yep.
That went pretty well for me. Like, that actually legitimately went well for me. I realized going with velocity trackers and things like that, hitting planes on 4s to 5s because I didn't have marker lights on them wasn't actually that big a deal. I still had enough to bring down like 2 in a turn pretty reliably. And then when I hit a Moncar, like, who knows? A Kalyon, and I got the reroll to hit. I could do even more. I could get like the third one down. So I thought, you know, actually that was actually reasonable. And so I didn't miss them all that much. Yeah, it started getting pretty bad when I started. So some of the guys in the region started taking things to make my life even harder, like a lot of psychic powers to give me extra -1s, like the horror. And I think it was Mass Hypnosis from Gene Steel Occult. Oh. And then all of a sudden I've got Riptides hitting on 6s and stuff. And I'm like, well, they're useless.
Yeah.
But yeah, like there's a balance to find with Markalites, but I'm of the opinion that less is more. Like, it's very hard to go for the 5 on units that are worth going it on. Like, trying to get 5 Markalites on a unit of Possessed that they don't want you to get 5 Markalites on, you're never going to do it because they're going to stay at like -2, -3 to hit or being untargetable. So there was no point bringing the Markalites because Markalighting up like 10 cultists that you were going to like completely trounce anyway is a waste of Markalites. The only times I really, really love them, like really love them, is against like knights and big stuff where you just be like 5 on that one. I was only going to kill like 1.5 anyway, but that 1.5, that is totally dead. 100% irreversibly going to ruin that one knight. So stuff like that is I love Markalites for.
What's the name of the stratagem you're talking about?
The uplinked Markalite is the one where you get the +D3. So you get one Markalite hit, then you pay a CP to go +D3. But the one I was talking about just then was coordinated engagement.
I'm just going to make sure there wasn't some other things or whatever.
Oh, no problems.
Yeah, just for the... Okay, I'm with you. I'm with you. Following.
So that one is 2 CP. Let's say a unit of crisis battle suits or bodyguards. Pick a unit and shoot at it as though it had 5 Markalites and modulated weaponry. Oh, never mind. That's a different one. But the 5 Markalites, that's big because if you take, so all of a sudden you can have this big crisis suit bomb that can just operate completely independently of all other synergy. Doesn't need to be near commanders, doesn't need to be near ethereals, doesn't need to be near your markerlights, doesn't need to be near your castle. They can just go, okay, there's a unit of opportunity. I can just drop down 2 CP and smoke it, just absolutely dominate it. And then your markerlights and all your broadsides and riptides can just markerlight up something else. And like, you're just spreading your efficiency more thinly. Because what I find, and I don't want to have a broad brush generalization for Tau players, but a lot of the time when I was playing Tau and I'd view other players playing Tau, is they'd markerlight up one unit and then just laser focus in just on that unit because they had the markerlights. And then people start playing things like transhuman physiology. They start playing things like catalyst and things that, because people pretty, like, when I'm playing as a Tau player, I'm pretty sure if they're as good as me or better, I can guess when they're going to put their markerlights.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of predictable what they need to kill to order to dominate and to win the game. And so just knowing that you can just chuck all your defensive buffs on the thing that they have to put their markerlights on. But then you have something like this where it's like, it's almost a bait and switch. Like, you start putting markerlights on. Can you read out the stratagem for me? When do you decide to put these on?
Yep. Use the stratagem in your shooting phase. Select one XV8 crisis battle suit or XV8 crisis bodyguards unit from your army and select one enemy unit until the end of that phase when resolving an attack made by models in either of those crisis suit units against the enemy unit. Treat that enemy unit as having 5 marker light counters.
That's perfect. So it's any time in your shooting phase. It couldn't be more perfect. Yeah. So you dump your 5 marker lights from your farsight marksman and all those things into like one unit. Let's just theoretically say it's a knight into one knight, or let's say it's a unit of centurions, and then they're like, oh wow, I guess I gotta put all my defensive buffs on these centurions, and they play transhuman physiology. As soon as you start shooting with, let's say, your first riptide, they transhuman physiology, and then you're like, okay, well, switching tactic, my crisis suit bomb, let's just come down, it's gonna 2 CP on this unit of centurions and just waste them, just completely waste them off the board.
You've got, and you can do that too. Another, there's aerial targeting, which is another stratagem that allows you to count the marker light hit by one, up by one.
Nice. Because there are times.
Yeah, select one enemy unit until the end of that phase when resolving an attack made by the ranged weapon by a model from your army against that unit. Treat that unit as having one more marker light counter on it than it actually has for that attack.
Because legitimately, you're going to fall short sometimes as well. You're going to get to 4 and be like, I wish I got to 5. I might lose the game because I didn't get to 5, you know?
Yeah,
that's actually really good. So now you could theoretically, so you put one marker light on them, you got uplinked marker lights, that's one CP to add D3 marker lights to that model. And then let's say you get a 5 or a 6. And so you've gone to 4, one more CP, you've gone straight to 5. That's one marker light to get to 5, one marker light and 2 CP to get to 5 marker lights. And now you've got another 2 CP strat for a crisis suit unit to also get to 5 marker lights automatically. So, and then on top of that, you can just shoot 5 marker lights at something. So theoretically, you could have 5 marker lights on 3 different units without taking a huge density of them.
And that doesn't happen very often strong. For Tau, does it?
No, never, never, never. The best I've been able to do is get 2 units to 5. Like, one of them, you use 2 farsight marksmen on, and then you uplink and try and get to a 5 or a 6 on the plus 3, and then you shoot 5, like a couple of farsight marksmen, some fire blades, and maybe some marker drones into another one to try and get to 5. But yeah, usually you only get 2. This is getting to 3, and getting to 3 consistently as long as you've got CP, that seems pretty strong.
Well,
that seems
like also a pretty good thing. I know this is, I guess, a signature system or whatever, but they have a way to get back CP if necessary.
Yeah, true. But that, you'll be giving that up if you wanted to get the But you could still buy that, couldn't you? That's the other way, the other get around. Yeah, so you can give up your first free relic to get the experimental systems, and then just pay a CP to buy a relic. That's the other way of getting
at
it.
I guess so.
So yeah, it's the same difference, really. So it doesn't need a stratagem to give you extra experimental weaponry. You've already got it built into your codex rather than in Psychic Awakening. There's the modulated weaponry strat, which lets a non-Titanic unit max out the number of shots on the random number of shots. The only real thing I can think of is ion cannons on Riptides, which have been notoriously underloved. So it said 9 Titanic, but did it say battle suit unit? Can you have looked at one for me, modulated weaponry?
Yeah, that's it. So other than Titanic, any set model other than Titanic.
Oh, so it works on hammerheads. Cool, yeah. Cool. So hammerheads have, when you take an ion cannon on a hammerhead, it has, is it D6 shots?
And it's only heavy weapons too, so it's heavy weapons for the model.
Nice. Okay, well, I don't think there's a... one in a game that has a non-heavy, big variable shot weapon. So just quickly, just looking to hammerheads, because I think the ion cannons on them have variable shots. I believe they're D6. And unlike a lot of other...
Yeah, the ion cannon, the ion cannon has a, it's heavy 3, it's standard. You can overcharge it to heavy D6.
Yeah,
really important there. If you roll the 1s, then you're suffering mortal wounds, but you are firing flat damage 3, -2 AP damage, strength 8.
Yeah, it's quite strong. It's quite a strong... Well, it's a relic battle cannon from the Hammer of Sunderance, relic battle cannon from... Yeah. Guard. It's the same profile. Yeah. Having flat 6 shots on that is amazing.
You are right about that. You almost never see a model equipped, like especially the hammerhead. You've rarely ever seen a hammerhead with an ion cannon on top.
Yeah, I mean, they did have a little bit of a heyday when they first got their codex. Well, that was when that's when people thought hammerheads might be the go. But then they switched to Riptides, and I don't think anybody's looked back for a long time now.
Well, Riptides, because they had that big point. People are like, oh, man, I can't be paying 300 points for a model.
Yeah, exactly
Turns out you can, and you should.
Absolutely. Absolutely, you can. And on top of that, they're friggin' amazing. but, yeah, look, Riptides are the best. Like, if you had, like, a character, you know, I talk about this sometimes. You had a D&D character sheet with its like characteristics. Like it's got a 2+ armor or a 5+ invuln or a 3+ invuln. Like its durability is like nearly maxed. Damage output is high. It's not crazy high, but it's pretty high. And then with buffs and stuff, it goes to very high. It's quick with movement 12. It's got 14 wounds. Like it's got high toughness. It's like all its bars are like nearly maxed. Like, yeah, it's a good unit. Very well rounded.
Yeah. So stuff in these things also, you might want to look for ways they can combine with your prototype weapon systems. I mean, there's probably a lot of ways you can interact with that, which, you know, we're not exploring right now.
What's a stratagem you've seen that you're excited about?
Those are the good ones. At least those are the ones that I'm most excited about, I should say. I think that some of the other stuff, like, I mean, there's things in here that help out underperforming units. Like, there's stuff for Kroot. I guess I'm just not seeing that you're going to really see them come to the forefront. I think there's enough in here that makes the good stuff in Tau even better. So you'll probably just see people continue to double down on that. Those were the most exciting stratagems to me. And I think that coordinated engagement and then the aerial targeting give you that one more marker light in some situations will probably be the go-tos, like the CP draws out of this one.
Yeah. Now, so the other big thing that's come across my waves is Farsight Enclaves getting a bunch of different stuff. The biggest one that I can see is them getting double the amount of commanders. So you can take 6 commanders in a Farsight Enclaves detachment. And as far as I know, with the exception of Riptides, there's no better unit in the Tau book than a commander, a Crisis Commander or a Cold Star Commander. arguably, Riptides are on par. Maybe one's better, one's worse, but Riptides and commanders are the two best units in that book. I don't think there's much argument about that. But having 6 commanders now in an army, remember why they stopped? They didn't let us do that anymore. You remember back then, Paul, when people were taking like 10 of the things and just sitting in behind like 80 drones, and they all had like missile pods and cyclic ions and stuff. And they're just devastating because on top of leveraging the fact that they're durable for their points, they're very dynamic and quick, especially when they're cold stars. They can deep strike when they're not cold stars, and they take a variety of different weapons that can be like customized to whatever you're afraid of in your meta. They got the character keyword, so you can't even shoot the bloody things. So yeah, I think this is pretty nice.
Yeah. So what you're saying is it's a match play rule for commanders. If you are playing a match play game with a Battleforged army, you can include no more than 2 Farsight Enclave commander units in each detachment.
Yeah. So you can now use commanders. Right. Yeah. So 3 detachments, 2 commanders in each one. And yeah, that's, I love it. I think it's tasty. I think it's very powerful. I've certainly have been on the receiving end of the Fusion Cold Star commanders that you're like sitting there minding your own business, just being a good boy on your objectives. Oh, don't worry about me. I'm just in my backfield on my 2 objectives. And then, oh God, you know, Cold Star moves 40 inches into your back line and kills your warlord. And he's like, oh, crap.
Yeah, and there's also the 8, which the 8 are difficult for me. I look at them and I'm like, well, this is a lot of text.
I went through that, and it's like a 1100 point army.
Yeah, 1120 points.
And they're all, they're none of them are customizable. They just come with what they come with.
Eight
and all the
commanders
have all
drones.
This, yep. And all the commanders have all this wonky stuff. Like one of them's got a flamer and a plasma rifle, and you're like, that's a winner right there. That's a winning combination.
Well, you're not, I don't think you've ever tried to play these because you were being super competitive.
Nah, God, no. You play this because you love it. And honestly, I think they're sick. I love the fluff behind
it.
I think
it's a great concept.
I would love them for them. I'd love for GW to put more stuff like this in the game. I'd love to see the last Schaefer's last chances come in as an infantry squad I can plug into my army. Like, there's a lot of flavor sitting on the sidelines in when you think about what they could do with other armies and, like, things of the same ilk as the A. Yeah, there's a lot of fun there to be had.
Yeah, I'm digging it too. But only for the look. I know that this is something that's been around for – the concept has been around for a long time. I don't think you're going to be playing this competitively. Like, you're not going to be a gatekeeper. You're going to be playing just for the love. If
I played against somebody who brought the 8, I would, like – I'd go and buy them a drink about 20 minutes after the game because the game would have lasted about 20 minutes and they'd probably have lost.
Look, man, sometimes it can be some wily playing. You never know.
I'm just thinking if you want to be the drunkest guy in the room, play the 8 because you're going to have like endless drinks by your opponents.
Like, let's take a break before we jump into some more of this stuff because we'll take a break. I'm going to put in one of those segments and then come back and be you and I again.
That's right, man. Awesome.
See you in a minute.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, welcome to a community spotlight segment of Forge the Narrative. I'm Paul, your host. I'm joined this afternoon by Stephen Box.
How you doing, Paul?
Yo, man, thanks for joining me.
Mate, thanks so much for having me on. It's an absolute pleasure.
So you have a channel, Vanguard Tactics.
I do, yeah. Started a year ago, a YouTube channel.
Tell me about it if you don't mind, because you know people that may not be familiar with who you are. I think you got a really cool thing going on. Maybe just talk a little bit about that for a second, and then you actually been wrecking shop with Blood Angels, and I want to talk to you about that also.
Yeah, definitely. So the channel came out a year ago and really focusing on competitive play. So a lot of the things that I did in terms of my battle reports are very much just focused on the best plays of a game rather than showing dice rolls and stuff. So it's a little bit different, but it's kind of evolved over the year as I've gone to more events, done more things, played in more tournaments. And the whole ethos behind my channel is to help people become a better player, both on and off the tabletop. So I cover a lot of things in regards to sportsmanship, fair play, and also just how to get the best out of your current faction or army. I think there's this kind of big theme behind chasing the meta, buying all the latest stuff, when really all I try and do is help people evolve with their list, find out exactly what they want to be doing with their units that they love so much, and really get the best out of them. So yeah, my channel kind of focuses on that, and recently just started a podcast as well called the Competitive 40K Podcast, which, Paul, I'm going to have to get you on at some point.
Thank you. Again, I really like what you do and how you present the stuff. So if anyone is not familiar with that, I think it's worth checking out. So let's get to the real meat, though. Blood Angels. You and I have actually been swapping a little bit of Blood Angel list talk, and you have been getting some success with something that I had not previously considered. And then, I mean, not to steal the thunder here, but like the ancient, the banners and stuff. Like, tell me what's working with you or for you, how you've been doing in tournaments recently, and then maybe, I guess let's just see where that goes.
Yeah, so when I picked up the Psychic Awakening, I thought, great, Blood Angels is out. I've always loved Blood Angels. Was one of my first ever armies when I, played as a kid. I had a big break from 40K, so coming back into sort of the dawn of 8th edition, when I saw this Psychic Awakening, come out for the Blood Angels, there wasn't anything that was really mind-blowing. There was nothing like, there was no Iron Hands kind of, feel to it. But there was a lot of really subtle changes that I thought, actually, there's some real play here. And I love an army that can essentially play in the movement phase and the combat phase. They're my two favorite phases of the game, and Blood Angels seem to do that in just a really sort of spectacular way. And for me, it was that kind of, I was actually going to take Eldar to the LVO, but then playing Blood Angels in some test games, I just fell in love with their playstyle, fell in love with their board control, wrapping and trapping, and really with the Blood Angels, in especially the list that I created, I would live and die by my mistakes. It is not forgiving whatsoever. So if you make a mistake, you lose that game. But if you play a perfect game, I think they're nearly untouchable.
But that's the hardest thing. Like, in my opinion, of the one of the reasons that the Blood Angels in their original form before Psychic Awakening struggled so much is because they had a lot of rules that just seemed to run afoul of the basic rules of the game or how a game was played. Like, on paper, they seemed like really powerful. But when you started interacting with the game, it slowed down a bit, lost some of that bite. And then Psychic Awakening gave it all back. Like, there were ways that, like, oh, this looks like it now slots in. You can do stuff with those guys. But it is, you're right, I think a little bit of a tightrope.
Yeah, and for me, that's what's so rewarding. So I had a really good outing at the LVO. My goal was 4-2. That's exactly what I got. And yeah, I played really, really well in the four games that I won. Made a slight mistake in a couple of the games that I'd lost. But I took a huge amount away from that. You know, we spoke about the Ancients earlier. So I run two. Do you want me to run through my list quickly?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so it's double battalion, and a lot of people are saying, oh, you know, you need more than that, but here's what it is, and this is my theory behind it. When I teach people about command point use, you only need enough CPs for the amount of stratagems that you need to play. So often we get a bit overwhelmed in the game with too many guns to fire, too many things to charge, too many stratagems to use. In reality, you need to focus on the task in hand, and you need to do what you have to do rather than what you can do. And I think there's a clear difference there. So really focusing on, right, these are the stratagems that I need to play. And I've actually created a cheat sheet. So if I go first, I run this list of stratagems. If I go second, I run this order of stratagems. And I found that double battalion was fine, along with obviously the extra three that you get for being Battleforged. So it's a pure Blood Angel mono faction
CP
list.
Go a long way if you play, especially in the first couple of turns of the game. And I think you kind of have to get a lot of this stuff done before you get to the Assault Doctrine.
Exactly that. And I would tell you about a game the other day where I just sat and waited for three turns until I got there. I didn't even move a model. But so I've definitely had some of those games as well. But the list as it stands is Smash Captain, Storm Shield, Thunder Hammer. I don't even pay the point to make him Death Company. I haven't really seen the point, to be honest. I then have a Sanguinaur, who I just think's a golden beast. Why not have him, given that plus one attack to everybody? He's a real force multiplier. Smash Captain's also my Warlord, and give him the 4 damage hammer Warlord trait, and then also the Relic. I used to take was the Angel Wings, the reroll charges, and Ignore Overwatch, which, you know, on paper, I think is probably the most common loadout. But I've actually changed that recently to a much more stronger Relic. And my whole list revolves around, and my whole ethos behind the game is about repeatable results. Mm-hmm. So I'll never try and put myself in a situation where the thing I'm trying to achieve is going to fail. So I like to build in a lot of redundancies. And within Psychic Awakening, we got a new Relic, and I'm just going to try and find the name of it now. But it's called Icon of the Angel. And that icon, when a charge roll is made within 3 inches of this guy, you can re-roll any of the dice, which is so strong when we're charging. So
that's in the special issue war gear, right? One of those, yep. Mm-hmm.
One of those new ones. And when you got that 3D 6-inch charge, I mean, I've been there and I've rolled 3 ones before. So
being it's like a knife in the gut, man. It's
brutal. Yeah. So being able to re-roll any of those is huge. Or even if you make your charge, you can re-roll one of the dice to maybe extend your ability to get a wrapping trap off or a pile in a tag. So, I mean, for me, that is game-breaking in some instances. So, yeah, that's kind of typically the loadout for that. I've got 3 units of incursors.
Can we pause on the wrapping trap comment for just a minute?
Yeah, sure.
So that's what you... How you're approaching this is specifically not just to use your extra movement to get in contact and make longer charges or charges from deep strike. You're saying go for that extra movement to get Hashish taking off, basically surrounding someone to protect you in the opponent's shooting phase so they can't fall back or, you know, fall forward is how a lot of people do. Really taking advantage of every bit of that extra movement for the subtle things in the game and in the phase that you don't compete as well in, the shooting phase, and even better in the movement phase.
Yeah, I think you've broken that down really nicely, and that's exactly what I'm trying to do. Is I don't actually try and kill anyone in my turn. I try and kill people in their turn, and that's exactly what I try and do. Wrap that unit up so you can always fight with your bare minimum attacks. So whether it's your teeth or your fists, you know, you don't actually have to use the weapon that you're equipped with. You don't have to use rerolls, because actually you want to keep things alive in combat, and then you're just making sure that there's no possible way for the enemy unit to fall back out of combat with you.
Sorry, I jumped in on the army list, but I wanted to bring that up right then. I thought it was a very interesting way of looking at it that maybe a lot of people do not.
Yeah, I think with the Blood Angels is, or with any sort of aggressive list, you kind of see red, don't you? Excuse the pun, but you kind of think, yes. Right, I'm a death company. They get all these attacks. Yeah, I'm going in. But actually, the strength is to not get shot, in my opinion. So I've got those two characters, three units of Incursors, which happy to touch on as well, why I've chose those. And then I've got two Sanguinary Ancients with Nakan, basically. These are Sanguinary Guard, but with the banners. And then I've got a unit of 11 Death Company with four Thunderhammers. And then in my other detachment, I've got three units of Scouts, Ashtaroth and Lamartes. And then I've also got three units of 8 Sanguinary Guard, one unit with axes, and then the other two units have got 2 fists and 6 swords per squad. And that's the list, basically.
Yeah, so you've taken some war gear on the Sanguinary Guard, and I'd like to hear, you know, why you thought about that. I think the swords are kind of one of that's reliable. You don't pay any extra points for them or whatever. And then the Ancients, you still have two now, but you're even considering a third. That's what we're chatting about in our list talks.
Yeah, I mean, they are fantastic. Not only having the character keywords, obviously really strong, especially now with the ITC changes that have come out literally 3 days ago or 2 days ago, really giving a buff to units that can hold objectives. And obviously these characters, they're really cheap for what they do. They're a bit of a beat stick in combat, and the banners that you can take with Blood Angels, the relics, are absolutely fantastic. Now, I was originally going to take one. Now, what these guys do is you obviously get the +1 leadership, and you also get reroll ones to wound in combat, so they kind of act as a lieutenant. Now, the main relic I always take without fail is a 5+ and feel no pain, so you can shrug off mortal wounds or whatever it might be, and that affects all the Sanguinary Guard and all the Incursors and all the Scouts and all my characters, apart from if they have the Death Company keyword, because it doesn't stack together. So that's one thing which just makes you a lot more survivable against anything like Thunderfire cannons, all that horrible stuff that we see all the time. And because our Sanguinary Guard have got 2 wounds each, having a 5++ all of a sudden makes 2 damage weapons become really unreliable against us, which is exactly what we want. So yeah, that's certainly a banner that's always taken. And then depending on when I saw the changes to the LVO format in terms of their terrain on the top 100 tables, I was forced to put in another Sanguinary Ancient because there was a couple of deployments I didn't feel was playable. Another new relic that we got was also +2 move with jump pack infantry. So now all of a sudden, with the Psychic Awakening, I get +1 to my advance, +1 to my charge. Obviously, you still get the +1 to wound. And now I've got this +2 move. So I've got, you know, Death Company in their movement phase moving. They can move 12 and advance pre-game with that +1. In their movement phase, they can then move 14, providing I've strung a guy back far enough to, you know, get that extra 2-inch move, which is fantastic. So, and then all my characters are now, you know, moving, advancing with that +2, +1, and getting wherever they need to be that force multiplier. So the characters don't do much in my list. It's all about those 4 key units. Yeah.
Dang. Well, obviously you said it's performing really well for you with what you've got now. 4 and 2, you mentioned that was your goal. Why did you set that goal for yourself? Or why did you think you were going to go 4 and 2? What were the things that were, you think, holding you back from going, you know, all the way undefeated? Where do you think you were going to struggle?
So the list struggles to anything with basically a high invulnerable save. So game one, unfortunately, I played against Grotesques in Talos. And if you roll hot on those invulnerable saves, there's not really much I can do. So that's a real kind of one of my weaker areas. And to be honest, I should have just played better. I made a few mistakes that I could have just not negated. We had a bit of a time issue as well. I wasn't hot on the clock as I should have been, and ultimately I timed out. That was one of the issues that I thought, okay, Grotesques are a big problem if I end up playing against a 27 Grotesque list. The other list that gives me a bit of a headache is also Imperial Fists with artillery. And unfortunately, I played Malik with his, who's from the UK, a top player, and he was running 5 planes and also 2 Whirlwinds, 3 Thunderfires, and 2 Scorpius tanks, and he went first.
Yeah, so no, that's brutal. Those planes put out just so much damage.
I can't hide from the planes because, you know, there was no enclosed ruins. It was just the L shape. So the planes fly over, pick up whatever they want, and then all that artillery, it doesn't even matter where I am on the board, I just die. And also the planes can zone me out from deep strikes. So it was a bit of a Going second to that list is brutal. Going first, I've got a bit more of a chance. So I knew that there's a couple of sticky matchups in there. But again, with these changes to the ITC now, I can play around that a little bit more and just really focus on the mission and kind of not need to kill so much.
Because going first, if you don't mind me jumping in, you're able to kind of give yourselves to zone in some of your own places if you want to deep strike or use on Wings of Fire or whatever. You get to kind of control that momentum of the board and going second with the flyers, and then it just takes all of that away from you.
Yeah, exactly. If I get to go first, then I can, you know, use the Death Company as a sort of a sacrifice, pick up two or three planes, move my units around so that any planes can't fly behind the L shape, so they won't be able to get line of sight, and just start to get an early lead on the board, which then forces your opponent to play a lot more aggressive with his artillery to come out and steal the board away from you. And obviously in both cases on it, I was unable to do that. And I did make a couple of deployment stakes, which, to be honest, I'll never make again.
Well, it takes that one. So, the burned hand learns best.
Well, that's it. You've got to learn from your mistakes. I mean, I keep a little notebook in. I write down, I draw notes. I'm very critical about my gameplay, because I think the only way to master a list is to really dig deep into the reasons why you're either extremely successful or failing, and really sort of try and pinpoint exactly those moments where the game might have turned in your favor or against you. And I think that's really important in that, yeah, big mistakes. Whereas if you go first, you can sometimes rectify your deployment mistakes, and obviously you didn't get that chance.
Yep.
So yeah, that's the list basically and functionally. And then last weekend I played a 6-round 100-man GT here in the UK, and I went 5-1. I lost to the Vic Vijay, who's actually number one in the ITC ranking as we listen to this, and he ended up winning that event with his like modified Brohammer Leviathan Iron Hands list, but with impulses, which just make my charges even more impossible. So it was
that -2 to charge is yeah. You do not want to be fighting that when you have an assault-based army.
No, absolutely. And you can't wrap them either because they've got the fly keyword.
Oh, even worse.
And he played the perfect
huge
game.
Movements, so. Right? I mean, they got 14-inch movement or whatever. Those things are... I've been basically expounding on the virtues of those tanks, and I think we'll see more and more of them as time goes on.
Yeah, they're crazy good. 4-up invulnerable save. Like, you don't even need to fire any guns. You can just move in advance, screen out, block things, grab the board. I think you can even jump out. It increases the movement of the units inside, so those eliminators just have a little bit more mobility. It was brutal to play against. And Vic played a perfect game. And it was late, game 4. I made mistakes. Going second, again, you learn from that, you move on. But I was really pleased with 5-1. So, yeah, onwards and upwards.
Yeah, heck yeah. So you mentioned that, you know, the changes in the ITC missions, and I think that they do kind of help spread the love around to other armies. And that's one of the things with mission design and mission sets, what you want to level set the playing field. You want people to be able to do things and then level set the playing field of what might be a lopsided meta.
Yeah.
And I think these do kind of help with that. I mean, making some of what would be the what seem are people kind of the boogeyman units or whatever either not be the path to victory. You don't have to go through those things anymore, or reward you for engaging with them and on certain other objectives. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's created a little bit more balance where you can't just go all out on one particular thing now. So one of the changes that was made that you have to pick a kind of killing secondary, and you kind of have to pick a holding secondary, or if that makes sense. One's revolved around killing something, the other one's revolved around holding the board, whether it's recon or it's ground control or king of the hill. So forcing gun lines that just can sit there and get the kill more, max out all their secondaries, and then destroy you before you're even able to score anything. Those guys are going to be penalized now, where they have to come out and do stuff. They can't just sit there, because getting the bonus point now is a lot easier. I think on 4 of the missions, I was looking at them thinking, I could probably bonus 5 out of 6 turns every single game now, which makes me, as I said earlier, sometimes I don't even try and kill anything until turn 3. So it just means I can score based on getting the bonus, focusing on any holding secondaries like recon, which is now easier. You can score multiple points per turn rather than it was just one before. And then when it gets to turn 3, when the Blood Angels just go absolutely mental and I can bring in all of my reserves all at once, completely threat saturate the board. And now I'm in that sort of pole position. position. I'm up on points. I haven't needed to sacrifice any units. My opponent's in there, still in their corner at the backfield. I can put pressure on from turn three onwards, keep them in their corner, and my characters can keep scoring me all the points that I need to get the board control. And it's a really nice plan. But it's about being patient and knowing when you need to attack, when you should defend, or when you grab an early lead and when you then pull back. So I think there's some really nice elements now to the new ITC mission pack, and I can't wait to, you know, do the next tournament.
So you think they're net positives, I mean, as far as the scene goes?
Yeah, definitely. I don't think there's anything that I really didn't like. I mean, I'm kind of, the big one was the seize roll. I mean, it's always nice when you, when your opponent's deployed really aggressive and you seize with your death company, but equally, you know, and you get to go first and move and stuff, but equally you don't really want to win that way either. So
Yeah. So many stories like, oh, I was doing all right until he seized, you know, whatever. But it's, I mean, it is a part of the game.
Yeah. So I'm not fussed about it either way. I'm kind of, yeah, that's the only sort of one that I know a lot of people have been for or against. I like the way they've changed deployment now. So it's just whole army deployment in terms of the speed. However, I think it's lost a little bit of the finesse of the game. There's something to be said with an army. So if you have, like, for example, Blood Angels versus Raven Guard, whoever gets to go first can control the board with their scouts, infiltrators, and incursors. And then it makes it really hard for your whoever's going second to then reclaim the board off them. So that's kind of a bit of, whereas where it's one unit, you could put a unit of infiltrators down, I can put a unit of incursors down. So I can hold maybe the left side of no man's land, you can maybe hold the right side. And then there's a little bit of tactical blocking, which, and then there's also an element of the part where you put the models down in what order becomes important as well. Mm-hmm. And I do like that part of the game, but we'll see how it goes in, you know, if the feedback is people prefer it this way, we'll just carry on with it, obviously. And obviously there's nothing stopping any tournament organizer running their own mission pack. So yeah, I think that's one thing people forget sometimes, is it's not just this is the high, you know, our way or the highway, so to speak. It can be changed based on the event organizer.
Now, I get questions all the time. People ask, you know, is it fine for me to write my own missions? It's like, yeah, it absolutely is. And you should. You should actually play. You should have things that people in your area, your store, your environment want to, whatever's going to get them out. So if they like doing this and this brings the most, you know, attracts the most flies or whatever, then yes. But if they're calling for something else, then play to that. I mean, but I think just the core of any mission design should be about fairness, where both players can interact with the game and feel like that they are doing something and
have a chance,
despite whatever list they may have chosen to bring.
Yeah, you never want the time, you never want the table, the terrain, or the, you know, a simple 4-up to determine the game. You want the best general on the tabletop to win that match, you know, and then that way you feel like you've been, you know, challenged, you've had, you know, exactly what you wanted from the game, which was essentially a really good laugh with somebody and, you know, had a good tactical strategic game. That's why we play a strategic game, you know, not just, oh, who can roll a 4-up, for example, when, oh, I pick this side, you've got no cover, I win. That's not why we play it, right?
That's actually one of the reasons I can't stand player placed terrain. I feel like that's like back there have been certain times where I have won based on where I put the first piece of terrain. And I just don't, I think you should minimize the impact of things like that. So when, you know, when I think that the game starts as soon as the game starts, it's in deployment, it's in armyless design, it's all that. So that all factors in. But, you know, there are certain things that you should take out the equation once you get there and people are trying to spend that 3 hours together in a cooperative experience.
Yeah, definitely. I completely agree with you. Yeah. So when's your next event then, Paul?
The next event, that's a good question. I mean, I'm doing a lot of preparation for Adepticon right now, which is in, I'm almost like scared to say it because I know how much work I have to get done, but it's in like 35, 40 days for me to be done with everything I have to get done for that.
And you're taking Blood Angels?
I'm taking Blood Angels, yeah. I don't know that I'm playing in the singles event yet. I am playing in the team tournament, and I have convinced the team to take Blood Angels. Well, I haven't. We haven't played it. Most people, three of the four people on the team are big Blood Angel fans, so it was once that door was open with these pretty favorable new rules from Psychic Awakening, it didn't take much convincing for us to want to sleeve them up.
And you're taking the Incursors?
Yeah, I actually have 10 incursors, I think. Yeah. I'm sorry, wait a second. No, we're taking infiltrators.
Infiltrators.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think the idea is to block out. And my list, by the way, we talk about patience. My list has Lamartes and Astaroth and 15 Death Company in it, so I don't have any of that stuff. I've got none of the finesse. I've got all the overhand right stuff. So we'll see it out. I know that we've done a lot of testing back and forth, and we've got some things in there like Contemptor Dreadnoughts and stuff that I think is going to help give us some advantages in the overall game past just playing rushing forward like
I love that
with the Red Thirst.
Yeah, nice. I think there's a crazy combo I came up with the Incursors, and you think, there are only five guys, but with the amount of attacks that we get now, especially in turn three, because you get two for being Primaris, plus two for charging when you're in turn three onwards. Obviously, you get that minus one AP if you're, pure faction or Marines anyway. So you're now getting five attacks base with then the Sanguinor nearby as well. So you're getting these five attacks, and then every six you roll to hit is an exploding hit. Now Astaroth or Chaplain can give that same ability, so every six you roll is now two hits. And then if you put Corbolo in the list, who priests are good, but Corbolo is an absolute beast, he gives it to you as well. So for every six you roll, it's three additional hits. Some of them you have to re-roll and some are just auto, but a squad of five Incursors can literally wipe out 30 orcs no problem.
That does sound crazy. Some of these things you think, it's difficult to like, you're talking about transports and we're talking about the impulsors and stuff, like regular Marines, and a lot of these characters are still just regular old Marine bodies, can't go in those things. So you run into like a weird kind of mismatch of how you deliver this stuff. It's going to be interesting to see how players reconcile that and overcome those things while we're in this kind of like weird state. I mean, look, first world problems for Marines, right? Like Marines are not suffering in the slightest. It's just interesting to some of the list build conundrums.
Yeah.
No, but what's next for you? I mean, I know you said you're evolving your list. What do you plan on playing in next? Do you feel like you can overcome that 5-1 threshold and go 6-0 or 5-0, whatever the format is?
Yeah. So I've got a 1750 tournament coming up. Is it another GT? And we'll be using the new ITC pack. But it's obviously 1750 for five games. The goal is to go 5-0 at this event. And I've kind of, again, looked at my list and thought, where can I streamline it? So I've swapped out three units of Incursors for three units of Scouts, unfortunately. I mean, I do love those Incursors just because they're so much more reliable, having two wounds each, a better armor save, and, really stacking that 5+ feel no pain. But I need the CPs. And again, it comes down to that because I didn't want to drop any threats. So I've dropped one Sanguinary Ancient, so I'll probably drop the +2 move banner, and then I'll probably, because that banner, I'm taking 50% of the time versus the other banner, which I'm taking 100% of the time. And I always want to design a list which works, as I said, reliably, which I know is going to be a constant in my gameplay rather than situational. Because I think too many times we focus on the little tricks in gotchas and we don't focus on the what's just reliably good.
Yeah, what's your steady performer? What is your 80%er at all times,
Exactly. So I've dropped one Death Company, one Ancient, swapped some troops about, and I've gotten rid of my Thunder Hammer on my captain and given him a Power Fist because he does the same thing pretty much. I've never had any issues with killing anything in the game. So I think the Thunder Hammer is actually overkill for the points, which is a bit, I think sometimes you have to really critically look at your list and think, do I actually need that? Or am I just doing what I've always done or what everybody else always does? Mm-hmm. And actually a Power Fist pretty much does the same job with that because it's minimum 2 damage anyway, and you just got to back yourself to roll 5s and 6s when you come to those damage and then you're fine. So
I do agree with that stuff. Thinking like that is what gets you to, you look at what you should be doing, not what what you actually should be doing. And sometimes you find that, I really wish I had a weapon that did neg one or was strength five or whatever. Then you just find whatever that is instead of just opting for the last can or the missile launcher or whatever.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people will be, when they go to 1750 or adjust their list, they take out something good. So the easiest option and the most obvious option would have been to drop a unit of Sanguinary Guard. But I don't want to drop a unit of Sanguinary Guard because I've built my list around them. I've built my list around this triple threat. The Death Company are just a throwaway unit in my opinion. So yeah, I've dropped out all the non-essential stuff but still kept the brutal threat saturation of that my list gives. So I'm really excited actually that my list has got a little bit better, I think, in 1750 versus 2000. and with the ITC being a little bit more favorable, I just hope that I get some good terrain on some good tables, play some good opponents, and yeah, 5-0 could be on the cards. So hopefully I can report back to you, Paul, in a couple of weeks.
I'm looking forward to it, man.
So yeah, that's what's next for me.
So where can people find you? I know we talked about it in the first part of the segment, but where you prefer people to hit you up or view you or whatever?
Yeah, so I've got a website, www.vanguardtactics.com, and that's probably the best place. I send out emails talking about tactics. I send out, like, I've got cheat sheets where you can download different things. Like, I've got, if you want to see my list in full, you can download it from there along with the Blood Angels cheat sheet that I use. There's links to all my podcasts, all my videos. That's probably the best place. Or if you want to get in contact, shoot me an email, ask me a question, and I'm always happy to be involved with any sort of questions going forward. So, and obviously I've got the YouTube channel, Vanguard Tactics. And yeah, that's pretty much me, mate. But honestly, Paul, thanks so much for having me on. It's a real pleasure. This is definitely one of my favorite podcasts that I've always listened to. And it was one of the podcasts actually that got me back into the hobby. I owe you a huge amount, Paul, actually.
So nice to hear, and I really appreciate you taking the time. I know it's a little bit later over there for you in the beginning of the week. So, man, I will check back in. If it's okay, let's follow back up in a few weeks and figure out, you know, how, if your plan succeeded, if you won this thing, what your, you know, and then how you may opt from there.
Yeah, would love to, mate. Anytime, more than happy to. And like I said, you have to come on mine and we can talk about your Adepticon prep and stuff.
Man, that sounds great.
And best of luck for that, okay?
Yeah, man, have a good one.
Yeah, take care. Bye-bye.
FTN is also on Facebook. Please like us at www.facebook.com/ForgeTheNarrative.
Hey, everybody, we are back. Hope you enjoyed that segment. I know I enjoyed recording it.
It was fantastic. Future self.
Hey, as a follow-up from the last show, make sure you check out the Bowls Open page. They're going to be doing some updates along the way. I know Thomas is one of the most prolific 40K artist out there. Our logo was done by Thomas. Almost every other podcast logo out there has been done by Thomas. They're also going to have a limited edition t-shirt.
It's almost a rite of passage, isn't it? You haven't truly made it until Thomas is like drawn something for you.
He's done some, he used to do drawing. When he comes to events, he used to draw on Battlefoam bags. So I've got a couple of really cool decorations on my Battlefoam bag.
Nice.
He's done. Yeah. I mean, he's very talented. He can do it quick too. That's one of the neat things. Is like you can kind of give him an idea and he's got a good vision and he'll put it out. He'll put it on there for you.
Man, Tao. Like I think they've just gotten better, haven't they? Like I'm not sure if it's an exponential increase in power, but everything that was good just got better.
Well, that's what I'm thinking is that you could build the same list. I mean, like the drone annoyance list is good. It's viable. You can play that. You know, what do? They move up to the center of the table. They kind of camp out there and then kill everything in your army.
Yeah. Well, ideally, that's like the play they want to do. They want to sit in the middle of the board, use drones to tendril off all the mid-board objectives and the little castle and just shoot anything and everything that pokes its head out.
People give me a lot of grief because they say that I'm unfair to Tau generals. I don't respect their generalship enough in the things that I say. And I'm going to go on right. I'm going to double down on that. You're right. I'm kidding. I'm really not. Would the Tau have to be good at because they had this kind of, it's not necessarily, I don't think it's a static castle, but it's not really a fluid castle at all. So they've got to be really strategic with where they position everything to make themselves invulnerable. Like they don't get that way by accident. They have to put in all the work in that and be very particular and specific to where they move everything and where they put stuff. And if they get even a little bit out of position, then their entire strategy gets boned. And so that does take skill. So sorry if I haven't come off that way in the past.
Well, so I have a love-hate relationship with Tau because I took them to essentially the highest level and played them for my country. And I disappointed myself. I went 3-3 with them. My 3 wins, 3 losses. And that's not as good as I wanted to go. Now, that was because me and Tau are genuinely, we're not a good fit for each other. They don't play the way I like to play the game. And it was actually a mistake of me to put my hand up and say, I'll play them. But I did get quite a bit more respect for them than I did before because you only have two phases of the game to play in. to show your craft, to show your expertise. You only really have a movement phase and a shooting phase. You don't have a psychic phase, and you don't really have a charge phase, you don't really have an assault phase. So you have to be like utter perfection in those two phases. You don't have any other fallbacks. You can't charge and wrap something to get yourself out of trouble. Like when someone's all up in your grill. I mean, you can, but if they're up in your grill, they're probably going to stomp you if you do that. You can't, you don't have like a double move from.
And it doesn't take much, though. That's what I'm saying is if you take your eye off the ball at all or decide to change up your plan, you know, this is one of the things we talked about on the show a lot is like, when is it time to change your plan? I think that some armies are a little bit more forgiving in that, to where you could, you, like Marines, you can get out of position with Marines, like, you know what? Well, I guess I just made some saves, or, you know, whatever. I guess I'm fine. Or you only killed one unit or whatever. Everything you lose out of a Tau army or make ineffectual in a Tau army is big time. And it's a short road to ruin. You need it.
So I think Grey Knights are probably maybe Gene Steeler Cult epitomize this the most, but they have options. Ability to do damage in the shooting phase, the psychic phase, and the assault phase. You have, as a Tau player, you have one window in which to do damage. You have one shooting phase window in which to do damage. And if you spud it, there's no recouping that. Your opponent just gets to gobble up all your mistakes. So from my opinion, like you don't have to know as much about the game, but what you do know, you have to execute very, very, very well. And so, yeah, I do have a bit more respect for Tau players. They're not an army I enjoyed playing, but because I've played them, I actually have grown in the game. And so I do. If anybody out there has an army that they think is trash and they don't like how it plays, you should play it. I'm of the opinion you should play it. And firstly, I think that's from the opinion that if you dislike something in a game in which you love, and I hope you like me and love this game, you should be open to playing it and learning why you dislike it rather than just being like, they beat me that one time and I'm still butthurt. You should inform yourself about the things you do and do not like about a thing you put so much money and love and time into. But at the same time, I do like knowing my enemy. I think Tau are one of the harder armies to crack, like psychologically and tactically, if being played by a competent opponent, and playing them is the best way to figure out how to crack an egg, you know?
Like, well, that's part of what we do. Try to bring a little bit of awareness about what some of the tactics are, to what to expect, you know, and so how to counter. I mean, when you learn that, you know, this ability only works within a certain range or whatever, then you know either to stay out of range or you know, swing the momentum in your favor to have them not be able to take advantage of that for more than one turn or something. Yeah. That's part of what podcasts and stuff like that I think are great at. I mean, I can't necessarily endorse more people playing Tau.
I just endorse people playing whatever they want to play.
Like, I just kind of like I kind of like the persona of not liking Tau. I own Tau figures. I shouldn't even, like, right now there's Tau figures in the house. Because I love the look of the big suits.
They're gorgeous. Like, I mean, it's the same as people. I've got a couple of mates who buy a lot of Gundam models. They chuck them on their mantelpieces and stuff. You can do the same thing with Tau pieces. Like, why not?
Oh, yeah. Oh, they definitely lend themselves to that for sure. And, you know, whatever. I think they even look a little cooler than some of the angular Gundams and stuff.
Yeah, they're a bit too chiseled, some of those models. I like how sleek some of the Tau models are.
Back to what we were saying, though, is it did. It doesn't change, I think, the power build. The Tau power build right now is that center of the board domination, and you can make that better with some of the stuff in here.
Well, exactly right. You used to not be able to get your, it used to be really, really, really hard to play broadsides and dominate the middle of the board because the broadsides couldn't make it. They couldn't get there fast enough. And when they could, like, they shot worse. If you want to move them every turn, they were shooting terribly. You had to guarantee marker light hits in order to be able to move safely so you could shoot without the penalty. But now you just get that. You just get to move and shoot without penalty. On top of that, you get extra rend. Like, I'm thinking of, like, what comes to mind for me right now is spamming SMS, like smart missile systems. Just how many SMS can I take that have negative two rend?
Yes, because the biggest drawback is that they you know, without the extra war gear, they're no AP, right?
Yeah. Without ATS, they're AP zero, which in today's day and age isn't going to cut it, especially when you're shooting into cover. I mean, they ignore cover and they ignore line of sight, but shooting into Marines, getting entry plus save, you're not doing anything.
Well, even with the back one, I don't even think you're doing too much, you know, with the cover and with, you know, without marker light support to get rid of some negs and stuff. I mean, on their own, they weren't that great. But now an extra neg one.
Yeah. And on top of that, if you can move and shoot without penalty, one of the downsides is, I think it's only 30-inch range on SMS. I'm almost certain of that. Yeah, 30 inches range. So that's another downside of that, because you're moving your Moncar up, you move in advance, and then you pretty much sit there the rest of the game. And either you made it to the middle of the board, depending on deployment and how you had to deploy against reactively to your opponent or whatever, or you didn't. But now that you can safely move and shoot, retain your shooting efficacy, which is what your bread and butter is, and you got better rend, out of line of sight, like, I think there's a lot of upsides here. I think there are all the best bits about Tau just got better. So I think it's a net gain.
I think you got to be willing and prepared to spend those points on the marker lights, though, those extra marker lights.
I think so.
Well, I mean, not the points in your army, I'm talking about the command points. Like, you have to go into it thinking that I'm going to do this in round one and two. I'm going to invest a lot of CPs into these extra marker lights.
Well, with all these extra ways of generating, getting to the fifth marker light, I think you need to take less in your army. Like, just taking a handful of Farsight Marksmen and Cadre Fireblades should be enough. I'm not quite sure you need the Pathfinder teams and the marker drones or any of that stuff anymore. So maybe just like a handful of maybe four or five marker light characters is enough to almost get five marker lights on two units, or definitely five on one, and then up to the three or four mark on another.
You can get them on the, you said, I know you said characters, but you can get them on the, like, whatever their equivalent of lieutenants are, right? Like the Fireblades?
Yeah, the Fireblades, yeah. The Fireblades and Farsight Marksmen are generally where the best places to put them, because they got the best ballistic skills. That's just as simple as that. Because the Pathfinders hit on fours, and if they move, they hit on fives, and marker drones start hitting on fives. You need to get some marker lights on them first to get real ones, and then, or you need to get a drone controller model near them to give them plus one to hit. So there are a lot of unreliable ways, and there are a lot of very reliable ways, and you're trying to find the balance, I think, one of the keys to getting the most out of Tau.
Yeah, I dig it. You hit the nail on the head by saying you need to take some, but fewer than you probably would, because you have these extra things. And then I'm thinking, you just got to be prepared. And then you can cripple your opponent in the first two turns of the game. I mean, that's common. That's actually very common. Like, that's what
100%
you want to happen, right? And now I think it's a little bit easier for Tau to do that, which is a net gain for them by a lot.
Well, yeah, and surprisingly, like in the schemes of things, like at the start of this edition, and towards the middle of it, Tau was quite a dominatingly shooty army. Like, their shooting was legitimately one of the best in the game. That's actually fallen off. They've been eclipsed, like wholly eclipsed by things like new Eldar, new Marines. Like, for shooting wise, Tau isn't like a hugely dominant shooting army anymore. They don't like wipe you off in two turns, whereas Marines and Eldar very well can. But what they do is that they stick around for six turns because of drones, because of their inbuilt resilience and all those things. They stick around for six turns, and they're a medium damage army at this point. But now with all these new stuff, oof, I don't know. I don't know what the ceiling is like for them anymore. They could have just gone up exponentially. Like, sky's the limit.
I want to see these Magna Rail rifles in action.
Yes, absolutely.
I think there's some play right there. Let's pause the Tau for a bit. Well, next week we'll come back with some Gene Stealer Cult stuff. I think that there, to me, I feel like the Gene Stealer Cult's got just a tad of stuff, nothing that compares to what the Guard got, and even less than the Tau got for competitive stuff. They have meat in this book when I'm talking about just stuff that you might be hot to take in a competitive.
Yeah, stuff you need to be scared of. It's usually what I like to look at. I'm like, if I look at something and be like, okay, I'm scared of facing this, I need to put it in the memory bank. And other stuff I can just wipe it, like stuff that makes Vespid better. I'm not going to retain that. Sorry, guys. Sorry, the Vespid lovers out there. I'm not letting that take up space in my brain. There's too many things I've got to be scared of at the moment in the game.
I'm with you. Let me do a quick finishing move segment here. So as you know, I'm doing this display for Adepticon, getting ready, this big team thing. The Adepticon team tournament is more like a pageant than an actual tournament. It's got kind of like an old school GTE where you're judged highly, like your appearance scores and your sportsmanship scores all factor into whether or not you're going to win. Without those, you cannot even compete or hope to win the top spots at the event, and so we try to knock it out of the park every time. This year, building a Blood Angel display that I can ship, like I can break it down into four different pieces and then ship it to the event. Hopefully that works out. Everybody cross your fingers out there.
You've been sending me pictures of it, and man, it is impressive.
Thank you. I'm hoping it all comes together. I've got this. I've got a cool idea on how to paint it. I'm actually consulting with the painting elders and asking for advice.
Yep.
I hit up my man GMM. I said, look, I'm taking a Blood Angel army. How should I paint this to make it look, you know, interesting and distinct? And he actually came back. He's like, look at Oblivion. He told me something from Oblivion, like the Elder Scrolls type stuff. He's like, look at that city and maybe think about painting it that way. I was like, all right, cool, done. You know, I'm going to try to do my best. It turns out it's kind of like a sandstone-y type look to it. A sandstone temple place that's on fire. That makes any sense. Or at least been on fire at some point in time. And wish me luck on that. But I've got the concept is that it's going to go from almost like a hell up to heaven type look. I'm going to start at the bottom where I'm going to put all the, like the Death Company models. And there's, I'm going to have this like pull the blood down there. Then it's going to go up into like the main level. That's going to be kind of like normal. Then we're going to get even more kind of into that like church type feel. With the character models, and we got some dreadnoughts in there. And then I'm going to get like super ambitious with the top. It's going to be like in the rafters, like above the clouds kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whatever.
I love the concept.
We'll see.
Yeah.
But down there in the Death Company area, I've got lined with terrain, you know, from the basilica or whatever it was before, the older terrain that has all those windows in it, you know, and so I've got them lined, and then I've got like this, this other part that's going to have like lit up stained glass, but on the lining the flanks, and you can see this on Twitter. I'm not trying to be overly obtuse describing it. I'm just doing a terrible job of it. But on the windows that line in the flanks, it's not going to be stained glass. I want to fill those with a blood effect. So it looks like the whole thing is sunk into a vat of blood, like, and then blood's behind there waiting to be pumped out or done something with or whatever. I don't know. Look, actually, I want to go on record to say the blood. Blood Angels actually do nothing with actual blood. The inquisitorial people are listening. You never heard this. We're all fine.
Lies.
There's no blood
lies
here.
And slander.
No actual blood here. But I want to put blood in these windows. And so I was looking for a way to effectively do that. And what I've done, I've got a couple of different things. I actually went out and got some clear quick seal. Quick seal is an industrial product. It's a caulk and adhesive, but they make it also. I use the non-clear stuff. It's paintable. At least the non-clear is the normal white version is paintable. So I actually seal like Forge World models and stuff with it because you don't have to wait for it too long for it to dry. It goes on with your finger. You just squirt a little bit out of the tube, put it on, clean up the excess, and you got a model that's sealed for 20 years.
Yep,
it's kind of a good product.
Legit. Yeah.
I went with the clear because I wanted to be able to have some texture for me to put some texture in these windows and then tint them with either Blood for the Blood God or that Tamiya clear red. So that's what I'm actually trying. I'm doing this clear sealant stuff. When it dries, tint it with this red, and that's giving me a blood effect. Well, kind of a blood effect. I posted I posted a sample on Twitter, and it's pretty much with alarming consensus that it looks more like a strawberry tart than actual blood right now. But I think I can darken it up a little bit in places, either with some purple wash or some brown or, you know, whatever, or even change the undercoat. I actually did a gray undercoat, the clear stuff on top, and then tinted the clear with the red. I tried it just on a black base, and it was too dark. On gray, I think it was too light. I think I can find something in the middle and then give an actual chunky blood effect.
Yeah, dude, that'd be sick. Like, so what? I'm more gory bits and pieces. It's all over the place.
That's what it looks like. Right now, it looks like a strawberry tart or, you know, coagulated blood, like, or like something melted. What's that movie where people melt? I can't remember anything. I know there's some movie where it looks like somebody melted. I just sent you a picture.
Yeah, you did. I get what you mean. That's sick. Have you tried like the Blood for the Blood Cult stuff? I mean, there are other products from other companies, but I found that's pretty good. And
it is good. Yeah, it definitely is good. I wasn't sure the quantities that I was going to need, so I'm experimenting with them.
Yeah,
just to see if I like the way it looks first, and then I'm going to go. But I want that texture, like what I need from coming out of these. I need it to look like the stuff is moving or flowing behind the whatever the glass there that you can't see is.
Yeah.
And so it's behind there in these big vats and pools of blood kind of thing. So I want some actual meaty texture to it, not just painting over.
So when the Inquisition comes, it's just bolognese, it's just passata, it's just tomatoes.
I have to assume they have some shutters they could roll down. Yeah. No,
they're just making a huge it's just a huge pasta bake. It's like an industrial pasta bake for the whole chapter.
That's it. I can't. Yeah, there you go. There's a really cool story from one of the original Ford Vault books where the mechanic has showed up to like get the STC plans for the Ball Predator back from the Blood Angels. And they're like, no, you're not getting in. So anytime anybody comes to the Blood Angels door, they just don't let them in.
And yeah, they walk up to the Flesh Terror. So why are you called the Flesh Terrors? And like, oh, Flesh Terror. Oh, we don't know what you're talking about. We're Fresh Terrors, freshly torn bread and cheeses. Because all of a sudden they're all Italian now as well.
Because of the pasta bake. I see where you're going with this.
Yeah. Somebody write a fan fiction for that, please.
That'll be on my handout. So we're playing Blood Angels for the team, and I'm very, really happy about it. And we're going to have a good time with it. And I think the display is going to – I think it's going to look all right. Like, I'm really happy with how it's going. But this – sorry to stay on the finishing moves. A red tint over some clear material, and there's actually a few different times. There's Quick Seal. Vallejo has a product that's a water effect that's, like, spreadable. You could do it to make bases with, you know, whatever.
Yeah, I've actually used that before. I quite liked it. I only used it for little puddles, so I've got no idea how it would go on a bigger surface.
Well, anything that I think that you can put that texture into, like the something that doesn't look just flat, I think.
Would you consider just using, I don't know what you guys call it over there, but PVA glue, like craft glue?
Yeah, I guess you could.
Yeah, something that's just as simple as that. Wait till it's half dried. And then like mold the surface to the texture you want.
Yeah, I guess the reason. Yeah, I didn't really think about that. But that was only because I wasn't sure what I was doing. I just there. Yeah, there's probably a lot of ways to skin this cat. But I've enjoyed this experiment, like kind of fumbling through making the base itself, and then coming up with different, you know, some new things to add into it. And you know, I'll do one window, and if I don't like it, the stuff you can probably just peel it out. See how it goes.
Yeah, exactly right. And of course, you could put in a skinned cat into your underneath the blood as well if you wanted to.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Sorry, that was super lame. You leave that in, Paul. That's the highlight of the show.
I don't think it's making
it. Everyone agrees.
I don't think it's making it. So don't be afraid to try stuff. I've actually building this display out of reclaimed stuff from other displays. It's like I need to clear up some space in my area, so I might as well take apart some of this other stuff and make it into this.
Yeah, conglomerate.
Yeah, but finding stuff and also I'm gonna Mod Podge the whole thing. I think if you're working with foam, you want to make sure that you coat it with something before you start putting paint on it.
Yeah.
But more finishing moves to come. I think this is going to be a wealth of finishing move activities. Please check me out on Twitter at warmaster_TPM, or you can find me on Instagram at Fights with Dice. The strawberry tart is up on my Twitter, though. It is kind of funny that there was, I was like, hey, everybody, does this look like blood? Does this look enough like blood?
I'm just picturing some nerd with a cup of tea and his little finger out being like, no, I think it's more strawberry tart, to be honest.
Well, the amount of people that said it was a strawberry tart, you have to believe they are right.
There's a whole legion of these guys with their little fingers out with their cups of tea, in fact. I have to wear a monocle.
And then someone actually posted a picture of the base, and then right below that, there was another Twitter from somebody else that they follow that was a strawberry tart, and they do look very similar.
Well, that's your thing, though. Why don't you just be happy with that? Go out and buy several strawberry tarts, and then you can eat your diorama after you've like had it judged.
Oh, that's it. I'll just wipe it off and be like, yeah, this is...
Yeah. Well, go get some strawberry jam. You get like strawberry jam. I don't know if you call it jam over there, but yeah. And just pour strawberry jam on it and then put craft glue over the top and seal it in.
Some of the comments were along the lines of, you know, I don't know about blood, but you've made an impressive tart. See, I love many foods, so you know, whatever. I'm fine with that also.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, dude. Well, we're starting to get off a little bit of a tangent, but thanks for joining me tonight.
I can feel my grip on reality starting to slip.
Running down the towel with me. And we'll be chatting about Gene Sealer Cults and whatever is next to come, guys. See y'all next week.
See you guys. Thank you.
Corner.